Please be seated. All right, we have one case remaining on our 10:30 docket. Busby versus Harvey, cause number 216-311-CV. I understand everybody's checked in and indicated their time to our clerk. And I believe we're starting with Mr. Young.
May it please the court. There's no more important legal strategic decision in a malpractice case, here veterinary malpractice, than the decision of who the plaintiff will use as their testifying expert on the standard of care. Likewise, there can really be no more confidential, privileged piece of information than the fact that the plaintiff is struggling and having trouble finding a local veterinary expert on the standard of care to testify in a malpractice case. The legal issue in this case is, did the trial court err in not disqualifying substitute counsel Bill Chambly, where here, on the most critical legal strategy decision in the case, it is undisputed that Mr. Busby, on behalf of the plaintiff, specifically and purposefully contacted Mr. Chambly with the purpose of talking to an expert in equine law, called him as a lawyer. Busby disclosed numerous confidential, privileged facts about the case. Now, that is in dispute, except for one critical piece of data that is not disputed by the parties was communicated in that conversation. And even Mr. Chambly admitted at the disqualification hearing that Mr. Busby told him, we are having trouble finding a local veterinary expert. Will you help us? Mr. Busby also indicated to Mr. Chambly that he was looking to augment his legal team to add more expertise on equine law. Now, that was not just to get Mr. Chambly to talk to him. In fact, additional counsel was added later. Now, it was added after Mr. Chambly showed up for the defendants, but in fact, we did add more counsel, and that counsel was at trial with us. Mr. Busby, it is undisputed, asked Mr. Chambly for a legal recommendation for a professional veterinary malpractice expert for the case. Now, Mr. Chambly then texted Mr. Busby with the name of the expert and the contact information and said, here's who we use. Now, that was the culmination, and it's undisputed that happened now. But initially, when the motion was filed to disqualify him, Mr. Chambly's written position was, I don't remember the call. I forgot about the call. Then he said, well, there was really only one contact, and it was a phone conversation. But I still don't remember the call. And third, in his written response, he said, I'm not familiar with this expert's name. Then, after the text message, and I'll come back to that, Mr. Chambly, within 2 months, less than 2 months, substitutes in for the opposing party, for the defendant. Now, the text message is interesting because it does say the name of the expert, clearly his contact information, and clearly said this is who we use in our malpractice cases. So we have Mr. Chambly at the disqualification hearing having to change his story. Suddenly he had total and complete recall about the conversation and said, well, we didn't talk about this, and we didn't talk about this, and we didn't talk about this. But then he had to admit, once he was confronted with the text, that he didn't know when he had filed his response. Yes, we talked about experts. He told me they were having trouble finding a testifying expert. And in fact, I gave him the name of the expert that we ended up using, that we ended up designating between the time of the text and the time Mr. Chambly appears. So the trial court erred in not disqualifying Mr. Chambly from representing the defendant. Turning to the law, there are two lessons from our Texas Supreme Court cases, both in Godby and in the Metter case. The lessons are, the disciplinary rules are instructive. They're good guidelines. they are not the be-all and end-all. In other words, the court is free to look at other issues. And in fact, the Metter case says the courts can go beyond the disciplinary rules to protect the integrity of the legal system, even if there's no violation of the disciplinary rules. So the next issue is, what is the definition of a client? Oddly enough, and I'm embarrassed by this because I'm on the disciplinary rules committee, oddly enough, the rules don't define the term client. But the cases that have confronted this issue say, well, we go to the rules of evidence. So you go to Rule 503, which does define client, and there it includes prospective clients. In fact, the definition has a two-part either-or test. One, if someone is told or given legal advice by a lawyer, that's enough. That closes the door, and now they're a client. Albeit in a prospective client, they're a client. Here it's undisputed on the most important legal issue in the case, Mr. Chamley gave legal advice.
Isn't there a distinction between legal advice and legal information? And in this case, couldn't you make the argument this was just information, the expert witness's contact information?
Your Honor, I would say there is a distinction, but here it's not just some legal fact. The defendants want to talk about cocktail conversation. An example of cocktail conversation, if an acquaintance comes up at a party and says, oh, I've got a case in front of Judge David Evans, what do you think of David Evans? And I say, well, okay, adore him, he's wonderful, he's the best trial judge you could ever get. You know, I'll say what I can say. That's legal information. Here there was legal advice. It went directly to the core issue in the case, who's going to be the plaintiff's standard of care expert. And for that reason, it went an extra step, if you will, than just some interesting legal data.
What if the reference had just been, I don't do this type of work, but I would recommend X lawyer? Wouldn't that be just legal information?
That would be legal information, Your Honor. But a recommendation of a lawyer to handle the case is different. And again, once the lawyer says, I don't handle this type of case, you're not going to see him on the other side of the case. Mr. Chamley withheld some pretty important information, that I represent this very insurance company, that I represent these kinds of defendants and these kinds of...
How did he know what insurance company was being talked about? I mean, he didn't have that information, did he?
We don't know. We don't know if he'd already been contacted, how he came to be hired and substituted in. There was already a defense lawyer involved. And so, again, I think it crosses that line. And, you know, there are always conversations that we as lawyers have to be cognizant of. If I get into this with this person, this acquaintance, this friend, I'm not going to be able to be opposite in this matter. So Mr. Chamley made his decision. And when he sent that text, he also said, I can't be opposite you in this case. That's what the rules require. And he crossed that line. Now, the other definition of client in Rule 503 is someone who consults with a lawyer with a view to obtaining professional legal services from the lawyer. And that also happened here. So it's an either-or test for client. Then we come into Rules 109 of the disciplinary rules and 106. Both of the conflict of interest rules can't represent a former client, and that includes a former prospective client.
Does Mr. Chamley claim that during that conversation that, or either side claim that, no, Mr. Chamley, does he claim that during that conversation they made any request of him to represent them, Busby?
Not a direct, we want to hire you. The statement was, we want to supplement our legal team.
Supplement our legal team or get local counsel?
It was not a local counsel. It was supplement our legal team with equine law expertise. Now, Mr. Chamley denies that. The testimony from Mr. Busby, which is always consistent, unlike Mr. Chamley, who initially said, I don't remember these conversations or this conversation, then claimed it was only one conversation, and then later changed the story again when he saw the text.
Isn't that conflict something for the trial court to do?
The conflict in the evidence?
Conflict in that testimony. Isn't that the trial court's determination to make?
Yes, but that doesn't mean that the admission goes away. The big admission was we talked about the expert issue and the problems the plaintiff was having for the expert. That is admitted by Mr. Chamberlain. There was no fact issue on that point to resolve. But even if you're going to resolve, the court is going to resolve fact issues, the evidence for Mr. Chamblee's side has to be clear, unequivocal, and not inconsistent. Here, it is inconsistent, because originally he said, I don't remember the conversation. Then at the DQ hearing, he suddenly gets total and complete recall. So, Your Honor, the other rule that's implicated in this case is Rule 1.05. Rule 1.05 is the confidential information rule. And the key part of that rule becomes very important in this case. Because 1.05, confidential information, when we hear it, we think, well, that must mean privileged information. That's not correct. Rule 1.05 includes any client information. In fact, as the Supreme Court in the Phoenix Founders case cited in our briefing, virtually any information relating to a case should be considered confidential. So it doesn't have to be privileged, although here it clearly was. It was confidential. You know, my cases against Kelly Hart, for example, the one thing, if it ever happens, that I don't want them to find out is I'm struggling to find experts. I mean, I can think of few more important legal concepts in a case, a litigation case, than that kind of information about the experts. And then the comment to 1.05 is also instructive. Because here, even though the rules don't define client, and we have to go to the rules of evidence, the comment, the first comment to Rule 1.05 is clear. It is one who is employed or sought to employ the lawyer. So here we have that communication. Now, there doesn't have to be a fee agreement, Your Honor. No case has ever said, well, only if there's a fee agreement and only if there are, you know, bills sent or time recorded in the matter. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on the cases. I do want to call the court's attention to one case we found after our brief in chief was filed. We provided copies to the clerk. It's the Hendricks versus Barker case. It came out late 2016. That is a good opinion for a couple of reasons. It goes through this analysis that I've just taken the court through. But more importantly, it wrestles with this issue of must the error be teed up by mandamus or can it be teed up on appeal? And in that opinion, 10 months after the failure to disqualify, an appeal was taken and the court took jurisdiction of the appeal while a companion court of appeals in Houston denied the mandamus. And the court said, a notice of appeal is a perfectly fine way to perfect the appeal on this disqualification issue. We also have a pretty strong hint in the Godby opinion, which was really the first time any court, the Supreme Court, had taken disqualification as a mandamus issue. And they said, we can take this as a mandamus issue, that's fine, but it doesn't say it always has to be mandamus. And hence, pretty strongly, an appeal would be fine too.
And doesn't the mandamus usually happen in more cases when a trial court grants a disqualification motion?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. Because of the financial incentives to the law firm disqualified, usually they'll say, well, we'll take the mandamus up on this. So, Your Honors, this whole error in not disqualifying gets compounded at trial in this way. At trial, Mr. Chamblee, from the get-go, uses this information he learned and goes after the expert as an out-of-state paid hired gun. Now, that may sound like, well, that happens in every trial, but here he knew he was on very good ground because of the confidential conversation he already had with the plaintiff. So the plaintiffs try to introduce the idea, introduce the information to tell the jury, well, how did you learn about this expert? Where did you get this name? And the court, if you will, sterilized or made confidential that information from the jury and wouldn't let the jury know that.
Didn't it come out in an answer?
It was blurted out partly, and Mr. Chamblee jumped on it, and the jury never heard the whole answer. And it was really a blurry answer. And then the court told the plaintiffs, you can't explain
that's
that.
That's not on the record where the court told the plaintiffs that, correct?
It was a conference at the bench, but we know after, it's undisputed. I don't think the defendants dispute that's what happened at the bench. But then after that, we weren't allowed to get back into it. And that's often what happens on the appellate record. I know you know better than we do. With these bench conferences, that's the danger. If the court reporter doesn't pack up her machine or his machine and come over and take it, you have some rulings that are made at the bench that don't perfectly make it into the appellate record. But here it's undisputed that was the ruling, and we were told, don't get into that. So, again, and the thing that was the instinct at that point of the trial judge, and most of us, yeah, that would be very highly prejudicial to Mr. Chambley's client to let the jury hear where that expert came from. Exactly. That's why he shouldn't have been allowed to appear for the defendants. That's the problem. And the instinct that that's grossly unfair does kick in long before that at the disqualification hearing. So for all of these reasons, and I'll address a couple of the points on mandamus versus appeal and a couple of other issues on rebuttal, but for all of these reasons, we ask this court to reverse the trial court and remand for another trial, but with a different defense lawyer. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Young. Mr. Walsh.
May it please the court, counsel. This is my first time to argue in Fort Worth, so I appreciate your hospitality.
Well, welcome.
My first case that I ever worked on with Mr. Chambley, who I stopped working with about a week ago, was against Mr. Young. So it's like I'm welcome everywhere here. I think, three or four main points that I'd like to start with. I think the standard of review takes care of a lot of the issues here. The standard of review is abuse of discretion, and that means that the fact findings made by the trial court, whether they're actually made as fact finding or implied findings, go in our favor. And there is the dispute about whether Mr. Chambley was being consulted to be a lawyer or not. The plaintiff's version of that is I didn't say I was looking to him to be counsel, I was looking for additional counsel. That's what he said. And it was talking about local counsel. Well, that doesn't make any sense for Mr. Chambley because he lives in Keller and offices in Dallas. Why would he be local to Wise County? It wouldn't make much sense.
Didn't Mr. Busby already say that they had retained counsel in his conversation?
That's Mr. Chambley's version of the conversation. I already have a lawyer. I'm not retaining you to be my lawyer. That's on volume 2, page 8 of the reporter's record. And then Mr. Chambley says he was asking me as a friend of a friend, which gets back to how the whole thing played out was Bill's neighbor is a vet named Gene White who deals with Bill and his horses all the time because Bill has a bunch of horses. And so that Dr. White apparently knows the Busbys and then Dr. White said, hey, I've got this friend of mine who is having problems finding an expert in their veterinary malpractice case. They've already got a lawyer. Can he call you to talk about the name of an expert? Which, if it's confidential, it's already been pierced by the fact that it came through Dr. White in that version, meaning that there's not a confidentiality that's been broken. But the point here is the dispute about whether he was looking for legal services or not from Mr. Chambley, all of the disciplinary rules, either I have to be giving you legal advice or I have to be in the context of I'm consulting with you about maybe being my lawyer. And the factual dispute there was resolved in our favor, which means that you can't come back behind that and take Mr. Busby's version of those facts because the trial court found in our favor. And that's the first thing. So is there an attorney-client relationship or was there even one contemplated? The factual dispute was resolved in our favor and we're stuck with that on appeal, which means that we can't go back and say he was looking for a lawyer. And that takes care of all of the disciplinary rules because...
All right, well, taking your facts, if we take those as correct, one argument that Mr. Young's put in his brief as well as his argument, I believe he quoted the Metter case, which essentially says you should also consider, to paraphrase the spirit, if not the letter of the rules, and to quote that case, it says that a court can disqualify an attorney even though he or she has not violated a specific disciplinary rule. In other words, if we're skirting the issue, there appear to be certain cases where the court should disqualify.
Correct. But they all involve things that are right there at the cusp of the rule as opposed to this, which gets back to what I was going to say about all the rules. It contemplates during the representation. So Rule 105 is during the course of or by reason of the representation. Well, factually, the trial court said no representation. Rule 106 shall not represent if you've represented. Well, trial court found we didn't represent. Rule 109 shall not represent if adverse to somebody you've represented. trial court found we didn't represent. And even if you go to the privilege rules, it's either you've given them legal advice, which trial court found we didn't, factually, or someone who consults with a lawyer with a view of obtaining legal services, trial court found that we didn't. And so all of the ways to get even close to the disciplinary rules require some closer touch tone of an attorney-client relationship, which the trial court found didn't exist here, which you could say that that's on part of either based on Mr. Shambly's testimony, or you could even go the other route that all he did was give them the name of an expert. And he didn't say, use this expert. He didn't say it was the right expert for your case. It didn't say the perfect expert. All he said was, this is an expert that my firm, that, well, actually the text is, my partner who knew an expert, was out yesterday. The expert we use is Craig Roberts, located in Florida. My partner had the same issue as you, not being able to find a local expert. And again, it's my partner gave this name, gave me this name, and it's the referral of a referral. And you can get an expert from an expert witness referral. You don't have to be a lawyer to give out an expert. So there's no fit with the case.
Right, but an expert witness referral wouldn't come in and serve as a lawyer on the case, correct?
Well, but what if a lawyer happens to run an expert witness referral? They might.
But that didn't happen here.
Correct. Which I understand your point, but he gave them the name of an expert. And then if you highlight in bold and italicize that Bill, in closing argument, said, and he's been my partner for a decade, so I have a hard time calling him Mr. Shambly, so I apologize about that. It said in closing argument, if you highlight it and says, they brought you this expert, Dr. Roberts, from Florida. If you highlight from Florida, it makes it sound like he's jumping on the fact that he's not local. But if you look at his closing argument, he's saying, well, they brought you this expert. The plaintiff brought up first that he was from Florida, but he charged $15,000 for coming to trial. I mean, that's a lot of money. He sat around the courtroom for 3 days. Bill had nothing to do with that decision that they made about when to bring him to trial and how long he was going to sit at the courthouse making money doing nothing before in front of the jury. He didn't necessarily have the right qualifications. Something that Bill never said was, and that's because he didn't do hospital work and primarily did horse exams and pre-purchase horse exams to say whether the horse is healthy or not, as opposed to treating a horse, which is what Dr. Harvey was doing. And so that again is the decision about whether his qualifications fit, not a decision that Bill made. That's a decision that they made. He reviewed an incomplete set of data in that the horse was injured before these events in the same leg. And the expert didn't review those medical records or those veterinary records as part of his workup of the case. And so the jury could just say, well, that's important data that he should have known before he made his opinion. The expert even changed his opinion at trial. Again, all of those are facts that giving the name of an expert had nothing to do with the reasons that Bill goes on to argue at trial of the substance of, they brought you this guy from Florida. Here's the problems with this guy from Florida. He charged a boatload of money. He changed his opinions, et cetera. And that's what we are dealing with, is it's a tangential argument of he's from Florida, but they brought out the fact that he was from Florida on their direct examination. It's the very first question, who are you and where are you from? And then they go into what is his practice. Those are their questions. Even if Bill didn't know anything about the expert or the local issue, he's still going to say, you ain't from around here. My expert's from Weatherford. That's what we do because we have this, the defendant has this advantage, whether it's Bill or anybody else, they're going to make that same point. And which that gets back to the very
big. Did Mr. Shambly ever make the argument they couldn't find a local expert?
No. They have an expert from Florida. The closing argument is they have an expert from Florida. He charged $15,000. He doesn't do hospital work.
So he didn't use the only thing that they're claiming, and I think this is what Mr. Young said in the initial part of his argument here today, is the only confidential information we're claiming is having trouble getting local vet as expert. So Mr. Chambly did not use that in his questioning or his argument.
Correct. He did bring up that he was from Florida,
right?
But they had already brought that up. He brought up that our expert was from Weatherford, and the expert decided that he wasn't charging money. But he didn't say they couldn't find a local expert. That's nowhere in the record. The best you have is some implication from the record that he said that. But the jury also heard, as you pointed out, Justice Gabriel, that the question came out of where did you find, where did they find you? And that I worked for the defense counsel, and then we have this off-the-record discussion, and then we move on to another issue. If they claim to have been hamstrung by that evidentiary ruling, they certainly didn't preserve error because it's not in the record of what the ruling was, and nobody moved to strike the testimony that came out of the expert's mouth that he worked, that he had a relationship with Bill in some fashion, which that gets back to the very point we're making of it. They have to prove that it's harmful error before it can become reversible error in the recusal process, and the very thing that they complain about that hamstrung them at trial came out anyway. Which, that, just want to get back to one other point here, which is it's not confidential information. The expert's location was an immutable fact. He was from Florida. Even the text message says he was from Florida. That fact's not going to change. They chose to accept going to get a non-local expert because they couldn't find a local expert. They had no expert. They were going to have no experts. As you've heard, it's the most important thing you have in this case. They're weeks away, literally a couple of weeks away from designating experts, and they've got nobody. They were going to be in a much worse spot had Bill not said, hey, I got this guy, not saying he's the right guy, but I got this name of a guy. Don't know whether he's perfect for your case or not, but I at least got a guy who will do it. And so they get beyond that issue. And that's why all that amounts to, in my mind, harmless error, because he doesn't say, hey, they didn't get a local expert, we got a local expert, and I know they couldn't get a local expert. He didn't reveal anything like that. Even if it was confidential, they told Dr. White anyway. I do want to
take Let me ask one question before you go on. It's about some of Mr. Chambly's testimony, I believe, in the hearing on disqualification. You know, he talks about, I couldn't even remember this conversation. And then someone pulled up a text message that I had sent, and that's how he began to get his recollection restored. And then he says, I didn't even have this file. I didn't even remember the conversation when the file got sent to me. Maybe you can put it in context as to time, but it sounds to me like a file was opened at some point. And I don't know how early in the process that was. Was that at the time of the initial conversation and referral, or was it later?
It was later. It was 4 or 6 weeks later is my understanding of that issue, because putting it together with the motion to substitute, when we get Bill is a very good trial lawyer, and he gets asked to substitute in a lot of cases. And this is the first case, by the way, that we ever worked for this insurance company. It's the name of the insurance company, I don't think, is in the record, but it is our first case that we had with them. And Kalina worked on it as the associate. And so I was able to confirm that. But so what happens when we get these cases in from somebody else, the first thing we do is we file the motion to substitute. So that's the timing of when the file would have been opened. And that is weeks after the conversation is alleged to have taken or took place. As Bill said in his testimony, or his statement to the court that has accepted his testimony, he said, I have conversations about horses and law every day.
Let me ask you something. Sure. In seeking information about a possible expert, certainly the appellate in this case would have had to have shared information such as, these are the injuries that the horse got in this case, this is the kind of expert we're looking at, these are the specific facts and situations that are going on under these specific facts, right? Or he would have never got, I'm sure they just didn't call and say, can you give us the name of a veterinarian expert?
There's somewhat of a factual dispute in the testimony of Bill and Mr. Busby on that issue, about one says I reveal all these confidences, and the other says it's only stuff that was in the petition, so that there wasn't confidential information. At least I don't do a lot of veterinary malpractice cases. In medical malpractice cases, I would get the question of, I need a person that does that removes gallbladders laparoscopically. Do you know somebody that can defend that case? I don't need to know much more about the case than that simple issue which is not confidential, because that's the nature of the very thing that's going on. And so it, my, I would envision that it would be that we got a horse that's got some lameness issues, you know somebody, would be very simple of how that would go down. I don't, the details of the conversation are not in the record at all. Does that answer your question?
Thank you.
All right. The one thing is they brought the Hendricks case today, and I do think that it has a couple of things worth pointing out that I, as I looked at it in the break. And if we turn to page 5 in the second column, the middle, the movement has the burden of proof. And then if you skip to the bottom of that paragraph, the movement must demonstrate the opposing lawyer's conduct caused actual prejudice. And then if we turn the page to page 6, and we look at the bottom paragraph on that page, the trial court didn't enter findings, but then it goes on to say, but the trial court ruled in favor of what it did, which was exclude the lawyer, therefore we can infer these things from what the trial court did. And then if you turn the page again and go to that same area of the paragraph, the lawyer that was recused says, hey, but that letter doesn't prove an attorney-client relationship. And then the court goes on to say, yeah, but we can't do that because we can't change the inferred fact. We can't go against the implied factual findings, and we're stuck with that. And that's how I think that case actually ends up supporting our position about the factual findings made by the trial court. I don't think the information is confidential. I don't think it was used against the plaintiffs. I think the factual findings about the attorney-client relationship or any prelude to it are go our way, and that's why under the abuse of discretion standard, the case should be affirmed.
Do you mind if I ask one question, Your Honor?
Go ahead.
I have admittedly not read the Hendricks case, but do you still stand on your position that the argument regarding the disqualification is waived and it should have been brought to the court's attention by this by mandamus?
This is, I would agree with their characterization that the law on that is in their favor now. I'm making this as a, because we wasted a bunch of time trying this case and time and money has become part of mandamus law, that I would say that we should have come up sooner rather than later, because we did go through an expensive trial on both sides when we could have come up on mandamus on this issue. And so I'm really making that argument to preserve it, to make it if I have to go to Austin, which I hope I don't have to do. So they're right that they can do it now, at least under the current state of the law.
Thank you, counsel.
Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Walsh. Mr. Young.
Thank you, Your Honor. To correct one thing Mr. Walsh said about the case we handed out this morning, and in fairness, we gave this to him about 30 minutes before argument. If you turn to the Lexis site page, page 8 of 12, it says, accordingly, Barker, who was the client, former client, was not required to prove that she was actually prejudiced, and the trial court did not abuse its discretion by disqualifying Proctor. Now, admittedly, in that case below, there was a DQ, but in any event, we're not required to show prejudice. And this makes sense. And again, the preceding paragraph talks about the integrity of the system and protecting the integrity of the system. And so, unlike common everyday judicial evidentiary rulings or rulings from a trial court on other issues, ties need to go to the client here. All doubts should be resolved in favor of the lay people and not the lawyers who have the expertise and know that even cocktail conversation can be a trap for them. And if they're going to wade into that trap, they need to acknowledge, I've taken myself off the chessboard for this case. I can't take this file. Now, I want to address a few other things Mr. Walsh said. Confidential client information can be public. It can be well known out in the world. But if it comes from the prospective client, it has to be treated as confidential information under the DRs. And so, again, we often think, well, confidential must mean privileged. But privileged or secrets, these can be public items and still trigger 1.05, as we have here. Now, over and over again, he said, the trial court found, the trial court found, the trial court found. The trial court made no findings, announced a ruling from the bench, motion denied, did not indicate why, gave us no reasons, no findings of fact of any kind. Now, it is correct that certain presumptions work in favor of the defendant in this case on appeal, but that doesn't mean that the court can't look at the evidence and determine if Judge Fostell erred or not. And the abuse of discretion standard doesn't answer the question. In fact, as this court knows over and over and over again and has found, courts can abuse that discretion. And in this area, we need to be extra careful because we are talking about the integrity of the system. And if you pulled any layperson off the street this afternoon and laid this out for them, they would have a chill because of the way it looks. And the appearance of this is terrible. But again, the rules give us the way out of this and this confidential information. And it is not disputed as to one piece of confidential information, and that is we are having trouble getting a local expert. Huge, important inside information passed to Mr. Chambly. And then Mr. Chambly reciprocates with, here's who we use, here's who we use. And then the telling phrase, my partner had the same issue. What kind of issue is that? It's a legal issue. It's the biggest legal issue in the case. Who is going to be the standard of care expert? And in fact, Mr. Chambly admitted that when Mr. Busby called him, he said, I'm contacting you because I've been told you, quote, do equine law. Not that you're a referral service. You do equine law. He's talking to Mr. Chambly as a lawyer, not just a horseman. I've addressed that there's no need to be prejudice shown, although here I think there was prejudice. And finally, the idea that we don't have the details of the conversation in the record is not correct. Mr. Busby testified about the details. I told him about the name of the doctor. I told him about the nature of the injury. I told him what had happened to Daisy. I told him why we sued this defendant and other details around that. That's clear from Mr. Busby's testimony. Mr. Chambly's testimony was simply a blanket. We didn't talk about other aspects of the case. Again, after he'd already said in a response and early on the stand, I don't remember this call. I had forgotten the call. So because of those discrepancies, I don't think here you're required to assume that Judge Fostell made a factual finding in favor of the defendant. For all of these reasons, we ask that the Court of Appeals reverse Judge Fostell's ruling not disqualifying Mr. Chambly and his firm and remand this case for further proceedings consistent with that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Young and Mr. Walsh. We appreciate all of your arguments today, as well as all the briefing you all have submitted. Your case is submitted, and we will now stand adjourned.